So as you know, the lessons are usually recorded, and here we go. Seems really dark in here today. So our normal approach to the Bible, the approach I've seen most often, as if it is a self-help book, right? Would you say that that's pretty much the common way to approach the Bible? The problem is, and when we do approach it as a self-help book, this is the questions we come with. What do I need to do to have a good life? What do I need to do to be good? Right? Those are really the questions, and that's always what you're looking for in a self-help book. What do I need to do? And this is going to tell me what I need to do. The problem is, the Bible actually wasn't written as a self-help book. I know we've been told that. I know we've been told it's an auto mechanics manual. It's not. The Bible is God's story. And it's about God and how God is putting into place his restoration plan. That's what the Bible is. And that makes a big difference in how we approach it. We don't approach it from me. We approach it from learning who God is and what God is doing. And that's the difference between letting what we talked about last week, Suke and Bios, lead you, and let Zoe lead you. It's God's story, and God's doing something. And learning and experiencing who God is and what God is doing will affect you. So you don't have to approach it as a self-help book. You don't have to approach it as, what do I do? Because I know that that's how we do. What should I do? If I just do this, I'll have a good life, right? If I just do this, I'll be a good person. I'll be who God wants me to be. I'll be holy. What do we call that kind of paradigm? Transaction, right? That's a transactional way of living. If I do this, then I'll get what I want. That's a transaction. And God never set up life to be a transaction, but it is how we live every single day of our life, as if life is a transaction. So, approaching Scripture as God's story, not only telling you who he is and what he's doing, but showing you. A good writer always shows first, right? Show, don't tell. That's what God does. That's what he's doing in Scripture. So when we approach Judges, the question we're going to ask is, where is God in this story? How is God furthering his restoration plan? The question is not going to be, how do I avoid battles? And that's everybody's question when they study, when they're looking at Judges, right? All they see in Judges are all these battles. All they see in Judges is all this living under idols, following idols. And so when we approach it as a self-help book, our question will be, how do I avoid the battles? How do I make sure that I don't have to go through a battle? It's not the question, because I can assure you, what you do is not going to assure that you aren't going to go through a battle. The story is about what God is doing in those battles, why God is bringing those battles, that it is part of his restoration plan for you and for the world. So that makes a huge difference. Do not approach Judges as if I can make sure that my life has no battles, because you're not going to be able to do it. And God never intended that to be the purpose of Judges. It's why we talked about last week and why we try to notice Zoe, why we try to notice God's full life and spirit connected in us, where God is leading, what God is doing, not only in Judges, but in our own lives as well. And for us to be able to notice what God is doing, we need to know what God has always been doing, what God intended for us to know he was doing, which means we're going to have to go back to the very beginning. And pretty typical of our classes is we almost always go back to Genesis. It is the foundation to know what's going on for the rest of the story. How many of you pick up a book and begin reading in the middle of the story? If you do, you lose the whole context, right? You don't know who the characters are. You don't know why they're doing such things. We wouldn't do that. And yet we seem to do that with Scripture. We seem to compartmentalize and take it from the middle and say, ah, I know what's going on. We've always got to start from the beginning. And so although we're going to do this over and over and over again, each time we go back to the beginning, we are probably going to expand on our vision of what foundation God has laid. So go back to Genesis. If you want to open up to Genesis 1, we learn that we were created in his image. Why does God create us? The very basic reason God creates us is to share himself. God is so thrilled with his being that he cannot contain himself, and it overflows. And he wants to be able to share that, to share himself. He also created us to continue his work in his name, so he is seen. In other words, not only does he want to share himself, he wants to share his work. He doesn't want to keep it to himself. He cannot keep him to himself. He cannot contain the delight he has in being and in working and creating. And he also wants to make sure that his kingdom fills the earth. He wants to share not only himself and his work, but his place. Remembering that when we look at Genesis 1, heaven and earth are one. That's what we see in Genesis 1. And it's what he's restoring it back to. He wants to share his place, his work, and himself. That's why he creates man. So, how does God begin? Look in Genesis 1. If we look in 1, and we all know Genesis 1, I think, well enough to know that the first thing he does, he establishes the foundation by giving us rhythm. So, what's the rhythm in Genesis 1? What do we know it says almost every third or fourth verse?
It was good.
Okay, so that's part of the rhythm, right?
He speaks of it.
Right. Let there be light. Let there be trees. Let there be animals. And it was so. He saw, and it was good. Let there be, and it was. He saw, and it was good. Let there be, and it was. And he saw, and it was good. Do you see this rhythm he's already created? He's creating a rhythm by giving us the poetry of creation. Let there be, and it was so, and he saw it, and it was good.
Well, Jill, I just keep thinking this is like, the whole first part is like love reproduces.
Yep,
you
absolutely.
Know what I
mean? Which is exactly where we're going to go, right? We're gonna see what's happening here. He starts with a rhythm, which is exactly what he needs to do, set a pattern. Set a place for us to enter. When you hear a rhythm in music, it allows you to continue on, right? It allows you to reproduce. If there's no rhythm, if there is something like jazz, true jazz has very little rhythm. It's very difficult, right? You don't really sing to jazz. Almost every other music has a rhythm that even if you don't know the words, like you can flow into it pretty easily. You know what I mean by that? Rhythm for dance, right? When you hear music, I don't know how many of you, and I see it in church all the time, right? They have just something that has a really strong rhythm to it. What do you see people doing? Yep, exactly. They're moving around. I mean, you wouldn't have not seen this when I was a kid in the Baptist churches, but you do now. We have that freedom to let our body, and we know exactly where it's going, right? How do we know where it's going? They set a pattern. Rhythm sets a pattern. Oh, I can continue on this. So even though I don't know this song, I got it. We are actually made with rhythm. It says that God has set eternity in our hearts. That's part of eternity, is rhythm. So, God sets foundation. He sets rhythm. That gives us the basis, the food for continuing on. It gives us a pattern for continuing on with the same thing over and over again. So, we have in Genesis 1, he sets a pattern, a rhythm. But then we get to verse 26. Somebody read verse 26 for me.
Then God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground.
All of a sudden, in that rhythm, we have an interruption. An interruption in the rhythm. And unless you're reading it literally, or you're reading it in the Hebrew, you may not even notice that that's an interruption in the rhythm. Something changes here. Does anybody know what changes here? How it's being told? From the beginning, it says, in the beginning, God created, and the Spirit of God was moving, and God saw, and God called, and God said, and God made, and God called, and God said, and God made. And now it says, let us. What happened?
It goes to first person.
Yeah. It changes from third person to first person. Not only does it change from third person voice to first person voice, it also changes mood. We don't know anything about mood in English. But in Hebrew and in Greek, there are different moods, and it changes mood. And the mood it changes to is called the cohortative mood. Now, to me, this was fascinating. Fascinating to find this out. The cohortative mood expresses desire, intent, and self-encouragement. Yes! Let's do this! And it implies that there is a cohort. Now, unless you've been in school lately, you may not know what a cohort is. Does anyone know what a cohort is? What? Yeah, a little bit. Okay, so for me, this is why this was exciting to me. When I was applying to grad school this summer, the first thing I learned was I was going to be in a cohort. And my first reaction, what do you think my first reaction was? A cohort is a collaborative group, a mutually dependent group seen as one. So last night at school, all the cohorts in the biblical studies program were introduced. This is cohort one. This is cohort two. This is cohort three. I'm in cohort four. This group is a cohort, a unity that actually is mutually dependent. And here are just some of the ideas of what a cohort looks like. This is what I've been told, and I'm learning how a cohort works. A cohort actually depends on one another to learn. So that we were told at the end when you have these huge final exams, not only after year one, but after year three, and you have an exam over all 3 years, each of you takes a part of what you've learned and learns it even stronger and then brings it to the class so that you don't have to do everything. You only have to learn one part, and then we teach each other all the other parts. There's this mutual dependence. It is not a classroom where you're an individual and you're independent on your own. You do your studying on your own. You just listen to a lecture. That's not a cohort. A cohort is actually learning through each other so that you're always in a circle. Last night we come in, we have desks, and the first thing we do is we start putting them in a circle. That's a cohort. A mutually dependent cohort. Let's see if I think I have a definition here. A cohort is a group of people sharing a particular event together, existing in mutual dependent relationship where each holds up the weight and glory of another. That's a cohort.
I always thought it, or heard it was two troublemakers. Like that's your cohort in crime.
Yeah. Ah.
Yeah,
interesting. Yeah. Isn't that interesting? We want to make a negative out of it, don't we?
Yeah, that's what I was heard.
Well, the interruption in music, you know, you have your refrain, yep, chorus rhythm. It's called a bridge.
Right.
So it's kind of also like that.
That's exactly what it is.
Invitation, yes, into what's
exactly going on. What it is. Mm-hmm. Yes. So in this interruption, what God is doing is, first of all, making a bridge to relationship. Mm-hmm. He's saying, hey, I want to make something that will come into the cohort. Mm-hmm. There's already a cohort that exists, right? And what is that?
The Trinity.
And he makes man to invite him into the cohort. We get to sit in that circle of the Trinity. I mean, does that not give you shivers? That we are created to be invited into the cohort with the Trinity. So he interrupts with a bridge to relationship. Not only does he invite us in to relationship, but he reframes the whole idea of creation being God here and creation there. He says, I'm going to step into creation. Not only am I inviting creation into me, I'm going to invite myself into creation. I'm going to be part of what I have made. I have a stake in this. Everyone in a cohort has a stake in how everyone else does. I care about how everyone else is able to do this. It's a cooperative thing. So different than a classroom, right? Where you go and you just are your independent self and you, I'm going to get A. I don't care what you get, but I am going to do my best, right? A cohort cares about how everyone does and lifts up and holds and bears the weight and glory of each other. And so God not only invites us in, he creates us to bring us into cohort. He also, in this interruption, says, I'm going to put myself into you. I'm going to attach myself to you, creation, to this part of creation. So that he brings relationship, he reframes the idea of what creation looks like. And the last thing he does is actually the most amazing thing. And this is always what happens in a cohort. He says, not only let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, but let's let them rule. I'm going to give over my power. I'm going to give over my control. I'm going to give over my authority to those in the cohort. Just like I will, in 3 years, allow someone else to study a part of it for me. What does that take?
Giving up suke.
Yeah, exactly. Giving up yourself, right? Giving up control. This is what God does. He releases control and authority and power to his cohort. He releases it. And he says, we're going to be mutually dependent here. I'm going to let them rule with my authority. I'm going to let them use my control, my power. What he does is let his light be refracted and be seen in all different ways. So you know how a white light goes through a prism? And what happens when it goes through a prism? It spreads out, right? Now we see what was in the light. We see red, and we see violet, and we see blue, and we see green, and we see yellow. That was all in the light. But now that the light gave itself up to the prism, it spread it open. That's what God's doing in releasing his power and authority to his cohort. He lets it be seen in all its individualization places, in all the differentiations of his light. He releases the power. That means he's also very vulnerable. And we don't often talk much about this part of creation, God's voluntarily being vulnerable. I have a great book that's called The Vulnerable God. And we don't think about God as vulnerable ever, do we? But that's who he is. He is a God who is vulnerable. And we got to think about what that's going to mean if we're created in his image. So this is kind of like, and I know we have a different culture, but when I was a kid, I remember junior high dances. And the boys, I mean, it had to be the boys, right? Girls never did this. If you're my age, girls never did this. Boys came up to a girl and said, "Would you dance?" Right there, he's being vulnerable. Because he just handed over the choice to the girl. He didn't say, "Grab it, her hand, you're going to dance with me." Well, I hope he didn't. He said, "Would you?" He gave over his power and control. "Would you dance with me?" That's vulnerability. Because Rob Bell tells a story about this all the time. Being in junior high, asking a girl to dance, and being so scared she was going to say no. But that was a possibility, right? That's vulnerability. That's what God does here. He releases his power. Would you participate in my being? Would you participate in my being? So, the interruption here in the rhythm is for bridging into relationship, inviting into the cohort, reframing, I am going to attach myself to you, I care how you come out, and releasing my authority, my power, my control, and giving it to you, handing it over for you to make that decision, whether you'll be in or not. The purpose of the interruption is to grow. Creation is never meant to be static. We so often think about restoration, that God is going to restore Eden as a garden. Eden was never meant to stay as a garden. It was meant to grow, right? Interruption is meant to move creation forward. I want to say that again because I want you to think about your own life. Interruption is meant to move creation forward. Eden is only a beginning. It's not yet all it can be. It's meant to be more, right? What's it meant to be? What's Eden meant to be?
A city.
A city. It's meant to be a city, which is what we find in Revelation, that Eden has grown into a beautiful city with trees of life everywhere. So the purpose of God's interruption here is so that Eden can grow into all it's meant to be. It's meant for flourishing. It's meant for creation to be everything it's meant to be. So we have rhythm. God establishes rhythm. He interrupts the rhythm. And then day seven, what do we have in day seven? Rest. And what we need to understand is rest is part of the rhythm, just as much as interruption is. So the rhythm is not just let there be, and there was, and he saw, and it was good. Continuation of the rhythm is interruption and then rest. And that's all we're going to see in Judges all the time. We're going to be not comfortable with the fact that there are all these interruptions. And we're going to say they don't belong there. And yet we look at Genesis 1, at how it began, and God says, yeah, it actually does belong there. It's going to move creation forward to make it all it was meant to be, to make it flourish. So it reframes even our interruptions. It reframes our battles and wars. The seventh day, he returns to rhythm, or really continues rhythm, and he sees all he's made, and it says God on the seventh day blesses it. And what it means by that, we don't really have a great handle on what it means to bless, but here God means, I am so delighted in that. It just delights me. It just makes me so happy to see this wholeness, this fullness, and the potential that is going to continue on. I bless it because I'm thrilled with it. I'm delighted with all that I have done. It's the feeling I get when I teach a lesson and I step back and I just feel, wow, I got to participate in that. It's rarely a, wow, I did such a great job. Literally, I step back and I think, I got to be a part of that. That just, wow, that is so cool to see that. I feel the same way about my garden. It's not, wow, I did a great job. Look at how I just ordered everything. It's, oh my God, God, thank you that you let me participate in this part of your creation that just thrills me, that just makes me feel alive. I flourish when I get to see that. That's the rest. That's the stepping back and being thrilled with being able to participate in being, participate in creation. That's what God does here. He's thrilled. Oh, this is so cool that I get to participate in this, in this fullness. It's so beautiful. It's what I try to evoke from you in bringing what brings you life last week, in the pieces that you either made or that you bring together or that you minister to. Do you get that feeling of, I get to do this? Not pride in, I'm pretty good, but I get to do this. When I left last night to go to class, I ran back upstairs and said to Bill, thank you that you're allowing me to do everything I love. I get to teach and I get to learn. I mean, this fills my days. And I feel like that's a privilege. And I'm so blessed. That's what God means here when he says he blessed it. Oh, this is great. This is wonderful. And then it says he sanctified it. And we often think about that as set apart. We have an odd idea of what it means to set apart. So I'm going to take away that word and remember that sanctify actually means to make whole or to see the wholeness. What he does is he remembers that this is wholeness. This is exactly what it's supposed to be. This fullness, a fullness that can continue to be full and overflow and full and overflow. I remember that this is wholeness and what it's meant to be. That's sanctifying. That's seeing the wholeness or the holiness. So that when we think about holiness, I want us to go back and think about this picture, this wholeness. Holiness is wholeness of participating fully in his being, of participating in that cohort and lifting up the weight and glory of another. That's what God means when he says he sanctified the seventh day. The seventh day is meant to stand back. Wow, this is so cool to be part of this wholeness, to be part of what it really means to live. The purpose of rest is to delight in wholeness, to delight in fulfillment. That shalom feeling of, and sometimes we have it, sometimes just fleeting. Everything is just right with the world. That feeling, that's rest. So, This is how God began. He established a foundation of rhythm, interruption, rest, which is all rhythm. The whole rhythm is creating and connecting. Creating, resting. Creating, connecting. Creating, resting. How then does God work? So there are layers in Genesis 1. Not only the layers of the foundation that he's setting, the rhythm, but also the way he directs, the way he creates life. How does he give direction to creation to be what it's supposed to be? We've talked about this. We're gonna spend more time in the third part than we did in the first two parts in a couple of times. So most of you are going to have some memory of this. I hope that we have a memory of what we talked about here. But God, first of all, with intention, he orders, he differentiates, and he names. So let me kind of go over that. What does that mean? He, first of all, has intention. He literally, I'm going to do this. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to order. So we see in Genesis 1, he orders things, right? Day 1, the lights. Day 2, I'm not even remembering what goes on in day 2.
Other cool stuff.
Day 2, all other cool stuff, yeah. Day 3, different cool stuff, right? Day 4, even more cool stuff, but different, right? So he orders. This one goes first, this one goes second. This one goes in day 1, this one goes in day 2, this one goes in day 3. There's a place for each of them, for each creation he makes. But in ordering them, he also differentiates them. And this is important for us to know, because we, in our culture, have somehow gotten the idea that everyone is the same. And God says right here from the very beginning, everyone's not the same. I've made the sun for the daytime. I've made the moon for the nighttime. I've made mammals pretty much for the earth. I've made fish for the sea. And I've made them to do different things. The sun is meant to warm the earth. The moon is meant to give light for the darkness. Do you see the differentiations he's making? He says they're all good, but they all have differences. And those differences, he says, are good. It's good to be different, he says. I've made you each different. I've made each creation different for a purpose and a place. And in differentiating them and ordering them, he says, in that place and in that space, you are all you're meant to be. That is good. So he names worth. When he names the sun as governing the day, he says, you, sun, have worth. And your worth is where I've placed you and what I've placed you to do. You have worth. So we've talked about this, right? In the last couple of semesters, we've talked about naming, right? It's part of what a priest does because it's what God does. The first thing he does in creation is to name worth. By ordering, differentiating, and naming them. You're good. You're good. I see the goodness of what you are. The second thing he does after he names them, and he literally names them with word, let there be sun, and let the sun be for this reason and in this place. He then gives them attention. So intention, he names. Attention, he tends to them. He cares for them. He nurtures them. So we've had this before, right? Naming, tending. Intention, attention. Intending and caring for them, giving them attention, giving every piece of creation attention, he, number one, gives them purpose. He says the sun is for this. The moon is for this. He gives them purpose. He also gives them place. They each have a place. The sun is for the sky during the day. The moon is for the sky during the night. The mammals are for the land. The birds are for the air. He actually gives them purpose and he gives them place. But then he also gives them space. He says, fill the space. It's an expanse, he says, an open expanse. Fill it. I've given you this place here, this air to the birds. Now fill. There's room here. There's space here to continue and grow. Space is a very important part of what God does to give them attention. And then he gives them the tools to fill, the tools to grow. He says he gives the trees fruit that bear seeds. He gives plants seeds to continue on and on. And I hope this brings you back to our little activity of having to nurture somebody else's plant, right? That was, remember, we were asked to tend someone else's plant. Give it all it needs to be able to grow. Whatever that is. And it's definitely, you had to give it a place, right? It was put in a pot. You might have had to give it a bigger place. You had to give it space. You had to give it water. And maybe even, did anybody fertilize their plants last? Nobody did that. You had to give it all sorts of things to allow it to grow. But did any of you take that little plant and force it to grow? Did any of you pull it and make sure that it got bigger? Now, I know some of you added a lot of seeds so that it grew. But none of you forced it because you can't, right? You gave it the space to grow on its own. So, intention, name worth. Attention, give care. But then God does the amazing thing of connecting. Connection. This is the multiplying. So, we've learned in the past that priests, we are priests, name, worth, tend, and multiply. So, in Judges, we're going to talk about multiplying, really what that looks like. Multiplying is connection, is giving vulnerability, giving over power, control, authority, so that they have the ability to be all they were meant to be. So what God does to us is he says, let them rule. I'm going to give them my authority and my power so they can be more than just a cow, more than just an ant. They can be someone who has my image and creates. And they can't do that unless I give them give over my power, give over my control, unless I become vulnerable and give them that choice to flourish. It's God saying, I'm voluntarily going to depend on you to continue my work. I'm voluntarily going to depend on you participating in my being, participating in my cohort. I'm depending on you. And I'll let you depend on me. I'm depending on you to continue the work of creating, of naming and tending, and bringing to flourishment the parts of creation that I've put you in. You can depend on me. I can give you strength to do that. I can give you direction to do that. I can give you places and spaces to do that. And as you participate in it, you flourish. Because now you become all you were meant to be. An image of God. Like God as creator. You get to continue to use that rule, and you rule, and you create, and you cause other things to flourish. Connection for God, vulnerability, is that invitation to join with sharing control in order to bring, and here's the other part of the interruption is, in order to bring good to very good. This is what he has done with man. It is not until he makes man that he declares everything very good. What I've just made is full, is the potential for fullness to be like me, very good. I've made a creature who can do what I do. That's very good. It's more than good. And that creature can take all the things that I've made good and bring them to fruition, to flourishing, to very good. I've made a creature who can continue my work to expand Eden, to not just keep Eden and not just make Eden bigger, but make Eden one higher octave more into a city, to flourish. This is bringing good to very good. It says God blessed them. How delightful to have someone in my cohort, to expand the cohort of people, to continue my work, to bring it to flourishing, so that I can continue to be delighted to see how it's growing into what it was supposed to be. He's just created man very good, because man can continue the flow of God's presence, of God's being, that overflow, by ruling it, by using his power, by bringing it to a place of fully realized potential. Does this make sense? This idea of flourishing is something we don't talk about when we talk about multiplying very often, right? We just assume, just make somebody else honor God. That's what we think about. But it's more than that. And it's this whole idea of allowing somebody all the things it needs by naming worth, by tending and caring, and then giving it the space to say, be everything you were meant to be. Be fully human. Flourish in who God has made you to be. And sometimes we even ourselves get to see those pieces of ourselves flourishing. Like I do when I see, when I leave here and know that God has allowed me to participate in getting to experience him more through teaching or in my gardening. Just sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes I get that feeling of, this is who I was meant to be. This fills me. I'm so full here. That's how God works. If we're made in his image, then we carry the same thing. We carry his image. We carry who he is and what he does. Living toward wholeness, what it looks like for Zoe, his breath, his spirit, to be in control of our psuche and bios. Means we have to go right back to what he did. We have to live in his rhythm. That's the pattern that will allow me to continue. His rhythm is the pattern that allows me to continue. Create and relate. Work and rest. Create and relate. Work and rest. That's the pattern that I will be able to continue and continue and continue. That gives me the power, the energy to be able to do the rest of creation. Breathe him in. Breathe him out. This is a circular fashion. Like I said, cohorts are always in a circle. It's not an up and down. It's not, I take in God, I let God go. It's not a straight line. It is a circle, so that it becomes kind of fuzzy as to where that breathing in and breathing out is. So that I rest in him, I take in his spirit, I let his spirit direct me, and I breathe it out by bringing to somebody else, I name their worth, I tend them. I'm breathing it out. I'm breathing out God's energy, God's vulnerability. I connect with them. And in that connecting, I then look back and rest. That's whole. wholeness. Oh, I delight in wholeness of connection. And so that it goes in a circular way of relationship, creating work, resting in relationship. There is this flow of back and forth, creating and relating, working and resting, resting, delighting and noticing the wholeness of relationship and connection. If I carry his image, I need to live in his rhythm, but I also need to follow his direction. And his direction is name with intention, tend with attention, multiply with vulnerable connection. Name with intention. I see something of creation, whether it be a plant or a person, whether it be an animal or a group. I see that, and I intend to see the good, right? And so the semester before, we talked about Father Greg, right? What does he do? He looks at these gang members, and he sees the good, right? And he names them. My son, you're so good. I see you're good at this. And he looks for the worth in them. He names them, gives them worth. I see that you're good, this seed, for food. You are good for a certain food, and you're good for a certain time. And so I will plant that seed, and I will give it place, and I will begin then to give it attention and tend it. Or if it's a person, I see that you are a person who can move really well. And so I'm going to give you attention by instruction and everything you need to move to your best ability so that I give you purpose. I say not only you're good, and it's not enough when I name worth to say you're good. It's to say you're good here. You're good at this. Very specific. That's my differentiation. You're good at this. So I see Laura Jean over this last year or two, you're really good at music and at leading. You're good at this, Laura Jean. I'm going to give you purpose here. So I'm going to tend it, and I'm going to give you the ability to use that. This is where you're good. This is where I'm naming worth in you, and I'm going to give you attention by giving you those opportunities, by giving you practice, by giving you time to do those things. And then when I look to multiply with connection, with vulnerable connection, I'm going to give you the freedom to take what I've given and you run with it. You go with it. So, Lara Jean, you figure out. You want to change the songs, you go with it. I want to give you that power. I don't want to control you and tell you when you have to do it and what you have to do. After I've named worth and tended, then I go, have at it, right? That's multiplying with vulnerable connection. I have a stake in what Lara Jean does, but I am not going to control it. I am going to let her choose to flourish in it or not. Yolanda, what did you bring today?
Cheese Danish, almond twist, and free Rice
Krispies.
Oh my God.
Now you want us to all
sit here. So Yolanda sees flour. Or with the gluten-free, she sees rice. And she goes, wow, that's good for food. Now, I don't see that. I see flour and rice, I say, oh, what a mess. But Yolanda looks at that and she says, wow, what I could do with that. Let me rule it. Let me say, that's good for food. Let me tend it and give it water. And give it yeast, and give it time, and give it warmth and give it a place. And then step back and let it flourish into wonderful things. What Yolanda has done is taken good flour and made it very good desserts. She has created as God does. She has not just made something, but she has allowed flour, good flour, to become very good bread.
Well, I think what you're saying, Jill, is that without space, it will become transactional.
Yep.
Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
Like if you told her every week bring gluten-free Rice Krispies.
Right.
Then you have a transaction.
Right. And what happens when I give no space? How do you feel about doing it?
Burden.
Now it's a burden.
And there's no joy.
There's no joy. There's no delight in participating in the cohort. Mm-hmm. I've just shut her down, right?
Well, there's no airflow, right?
There's no airflow. There's no breathing. It's this box I've just put you in. Be this. Do this. Rather than, I see you're good at this. Mm-hmm. Here's everything that you need, and then now take it. Or don't take it. And flourish. This is exactly what God does with us. My son is a furniture designer. And so what he does is he sees dead wood. And literally, I've walked with him in the forest, and he'll look at every, wow, look at that. And he stops, and he looks at the patterns and the color of the wood, and he wants to know about it. And you can see, you can see his mind going, oh, what I could give to that. I'm going to take that, and I'm going to give time, and I'm going to give my creative thought to it, and I'm going to give my physical abilities to it. And actually, I'm going to actually give it space because I never know. And what he does, I didn't bring any of his furniture because I don't have any of his furniture, is he makes bowls or furniture. And you look at these and you go, wow. He took good wood and made it very good. Transformation. That's transformation. And they're all different. And they're all beautiful. A TV producer sees bodies that can move. And he says, wow, your body really moves wonderfully. That could make for beauty and story. I'm going to give you instruction and time and space so that your movement is brought into a very good place, that you become a dancer. And so, of course, my desire was to show you so you think you can dance. Yes, thank you. Woo-hoo. I have a couple. You watch these bodies move and you're mesmerized by the story they can tell without words. The stories they can tell by the way they move their body. Someone said, you're good at moving your body. And I'm going to give you everything to allow you to flourish, to be all God made you to be. Dancer who is able to show you the beauty of God's world, the stories of what's happening in God's world. That's taking something good and making it very good. That's what multiply means. Multiply does not mean making more things. It means bringing what's there and pulling out its potential, letting it flourish. So many times in Christianity, we have thought, and it used to be, We'd almost carry a stick with the notches in. How many people have I brought to Christ? Right? I've brought this many people to Christ. I've multiplied. Except that's not how God multiplies. What God wants us to do, what God has imbued us in being in cohort, is to bring the full flourishment where we are. Things and people, all of creation, bring it to flourishment. Name worth, give care, give it the space and the ability to come up to what and who they were meant to be.
Well, I think of like Peter with Jesus. Like, I feel like this is like.
It's exactly what he does, right? Yeah. So, Natalie, what does Jesus do with Peter?
Like, lets him fail a lot.
He lets him fail a lot.
Yeah. And I'm just thinking of like the reinstatement when he's resurrected, of like just that conversation that they have together. And he's like nurtured and tended this relationship and then like set him forth to be.
Right. Exactly.
The rock of the church.
Yeah. Exactly. And he reminds Peter, Peter, you're really good at loving. This is why he says, Peter, do you love me? Peter, this is what you're good at. Go out and love. I'm setting you free. You're really good at this. Go do it.
That's what we do with our kids.
Hopefully. Yeah, hopefully. Hopefully that's what we're doing. But we're going to go back and look at, you know what, a lot of times we don't, actually. We do just the opposite. I have an article about a judge. I just thought this was wonderful. Did anybody read this? Let's see, was this in the Sun? This was in the Trib. Anybody read this? This woman is a judge in Chicago. Let me just read part of it to you. This is multiplying, is bringing flourishment. It's a Friday morning in courtroom 206 at the Cook County Criminal Courts Building, and Associate Judge Rosemary Grant Higgins is getting an update on the progress of one of her cases. It looks like you've really taken to the program, Higgins says, shuffling through reports as she looks down from her bench at the woman standing in front of her. Do you have anything to say to the court? The woman, who had pleaded guilty to prostitution and successfully received treatment and counseling, turns to face several other women from Cook County Jail who sit handcuffed in blue or pink jumpsuits. And she says to them, until you're sick and tired of being sick and tired, you're never going to change your life. She says with confidence, making eye contact with the members of the group who will look at her. No judge or sheriff is going to make it happen. You need to be sick and tired emotionally, sick and tired physically, and sick and tired spiritually. As the defendant walks out of court, Higgins leads a round of applause, something she does for all the women who make significant progress through the wings of a program at the circuit court that was launched by Higgins. It is an intensive two-year program that gives women who are arrested and plead guilty to prostitution charges the opportunity to be rehabilitated and receive counseling and job training. So it goes on to say she actually inserts herself into the lives of these women and sees that they flourish. Who does that sound like that we've already looked at? Father Greg, right? This is what Father Greg does. He looks at these gang members and he says, no, you're good. There's worth in you. I'm going to give you a job. And I'm going to let you fail in that job, but I'm going to give you all the tools needed to flourish. And I'm going to stick with you, right? It means something to him that these gang members flourish and become who they're meant to be. And so last semester we had all sorts of stories from those gang members. Here it is, someone in Chicago is looking at these prostitutes and saying, no, I don't see a prostitute, I see someone who has worth. And so I'm going to tend you and help you to flourish. That's multiplying. She now just brought someone who wasn't bearing image into someone who's bearing image, becoming more. So at the end, it talks about what these women have accomplished and what they're able to do. And she says these are the most marginalized people she sees ever in the courtroom. No matter what crime she's seen, these women are the most marginalized. And there she goes to name worth and tend and help them to flourish. So she just doesn't say, you have worth, and she's on her way. She inserts herself and she becomes part of, she has a stake in them flourishing.
What article was that?
It was in the Tribune. Thanks. Rosemary Grant Higgins. That's what, remarkable woman. I think it's in their lifestyle at the very beginning. So here's the thing. We get to choose what image we carry. There is a risk for God in his vulnerable connection with us. Remember, the word vulnerable comes from the Latin vulner, which means able willingness to be wounded. That's what vulnerability means, the willingness to be wounded. When God gives over his control, his authority, his power, when I give over control, I allow for the possibility of flourishment not to happen, of even diminishment happening. But vulnerability is a refusal to protect myself from wounding, because that would hurt, right, if they don't flourish. Vulnerability says, I refuse to protect myself from getting wounded in order that there be space offered for the choosing of connection, multiplying, flourishing. I so want flourishing that I'm willing to put myself in the line for it, that I'm willing to be vulnerable and to be wounded and to be hurt. That's what God has done with us. In his vulnerability, he took a risk. I'm willing for them to choose not image bearing, to not be in cohort. I'm willing because I need to give them space in order for them to actually carry my image. The offer, God says, is you can be like me. But it requires mutual dependence. It requires being participating in my being. The choice is, you can live in my rhythm, or you can live in another's rhythm. You can live according to my directions, or you can live according to another's direction. We have two choices, but only two choices. We can image bear, or we can idol bear. Those are the only two choices we have. I can choose to be in the cohort and participate in his being, or I can choose to be outside of the cohort and not participate in his being. And it has to be a choice. God has to be vulnerable because his own creative being is free. He is a free creator. He is not compelled to create. He does it because it delights him. And so if he's creating someone who can create in his image, it has to be someone who creates because he delights in it, not because he's forced to. Because as we said, if you're forced to do something, if you're told you must do this, then it becomes a burden, right? And Jesus says, you who are weary and heavy laden, who have been carrying around those musts, my burden is light. There's a delight in creating, but you get the choice. And it has to be a choice. He cannot force us. He cannot say, you must do this. The lure of the other, of another rhythm, of another direction, is you can be like God, and you don't have to die. You can be like God, and you don't have to be vulnerable. Where did we first hear that? In the garden, right? Genesis 3, that's what the snake says to Eve. That's what Satan says. It is the promise of every idol. Every idol says the same thing. It offers you the ability to rule and control without having to share that control, without having to be vulnerable, without having to give up control to somebody else. That's the promise of every single idol. It says, you don't have to die to your suke or your bios controlling things. Your suke is pretty good. You're just fine broken the way you are. You're fine being only part human. Suke and bios without that zoe. You're great. In fact, you're really good there. Your will is so strong, you can do these good things. It speaks to that broken part of us. Every idol does. You're great. You can control things. You don't have to give up control. You can have the authority God has meant for you to have. And you can have it without giving up anything. The problem is, when an idol promises that, when anything promises that, it will always take then what God designed to give you, and it will use it for its own purpose. Just like Eve and Adam did with leaves, right? Leaves he made not only for beauty and for shade, but to bring in nourishment for the trees so that the trees could give us nourishment. What do Adam and Eve use them for? To cover, to hide, to not be vulnerable. So, anything that promises that I can rule and have authority and I can have control over my life and I don't have to give up my life is, first of all, going to use its own rhythm. It will take God's rhythm that he puts inside us and say, well, it doesn't have to be that rhythm. It could be any rhythm. And the rhythm almost always that it uses is, I don't have to rest. Because if I don't rest, I'll produce more. And I'll get more for myself. Or sometimes the rhythm it uses is, I'm going to save up all my rest until the end of my life. And we call that retirement. I'll work, and then I'll have lots for retirement. But I think there was somebody that tried to do that a long time ago in a desert. What did they do?
Oh, they tried to keep the manna.
Yeah, and what happens?
It spoils.
It spoils. It rots. God's rhythm works. Any other rhythm doesn't. But every idol, every other way of being independent will take on another rhythm. Sometimes the rhythm is not to have margins for interruptions. But didn't we just learn that interruptions is part of the rhythm? So if my life is packed so that I cannot have interruptions, and what is interruptions for? To move us forward, to grow us. And I have a life that is marginless, I don't have God's rhythm then. But I can control it, right? As long as everything works just right, I can control it. Any idol says, you get to control your time. It's your life, after all. You have the right to decide how to use your time. Not only will it take God's rhythm and change the rhythm, but it will take God's direction and use it for its own use, for my use. So, it will take authority without connection, vulnerability. Not in order to flourish, but in order to meet my desires of suke or bios. I will try to name, but in my naming, it won't be for worth. It will be done to evaluate, to judge. This is good for me. This is not good for me. Oh, you have a swimming pool? You're gonna be my good friend. You know somebody there. Oh, you're my good friend. I name worth in you. You're gonna be a good friend for me because I see you're gonna be useful for me. Not to give you worth, but to give me worth. I will tend others. I will give them all sorts of things that they need so that they will become useful to me. And this is where it gets really murky with our kids. I will put everything I can into you so that... Okay, so I just thought something personal. I thought, oh. We sent Christian to Wheaton College. Oh, this is great. Bible and theology major, yes. Oh, yes, my son is a Bible and theology major. Yes, my son's going to be a pastor. And he ends up being a woodmaker. Did I tend? Did I give him what he needs so that he can be everything he was meant to be? Was there a part of me that said, I'm going to tend you so that you reflect good on me? Now, am I the only one who's ever done that with their children? Yeah, right? That's kind of common, right? We do that all the time. My next door neighbor, who used to live there, it always amazed me. He is one of the vice presidents of NALCO. He doesn't live there anymore. Vice President of NALCO, his firstborn, a son, his only son, decides he doesn't want to go to college. He wants to be a mechanic. Okay, in Naperville, what does that look like? What do you think everyone told him? You got to force him to go to college, right? You know what? He said, Brian is really good with his hands. And I'm going to allow him to follow this path. And literally, I just sat there thinking, wow, you are the vice president of NALCO. And you're going to let your son go be a mechanic. Brian has flourished. And I will tell you, out of their three kids, the two girls went to college. Brian did not. Brian owns a huge business. Does really well and is thrilled with his life. He's flourishing. That is exactly what that looks like. I don't tend. If I'm not image bearing, then I will tend in order to build myself up, to get them to be useful to me. And when I multiply, I will do that first multiplication that we talked about. I will make more people like me. I will make more people, and this is how it usually comes about. I will try to keep them in a small box, not allow them to grow, so I can maintain control. In other words, there will be something my suke or bios wants to do, a behavior, a way of thinking. And I'll make sure I gather around a lot of people to adopt that way of thinking or that behavior. So that now I have lots of people saying, yeah, that's good, you should do that. Yeah, we should do that. So that now I feel good about doing that or about thinking that way. And what I've done is now made a people who are going to be defensive about a behavior or defensive about a way of thinking, and they're now in a small box. They haven't flourished, nor have I. And that this is always a little bit more nebulous than the tending, the naming. But boy, I saw an advertisement almost always does this. It tries to multiply by having you adopt their way of thinking and keeping you in a box. Here was the advertisement. Anybody see this? It says, "And on the seventh day, you cleaned." What's it trying to do? Hey, we got 7 days. We should use them all. Rallying around no rest. You can be more productive, and we're going to help you. New Testament talks about this a lot. We're going to help you have your own rhythm so you can be more productive. The problem is you have not just, in calling them to this, you have not helped them to flourish. You've just taken away their power to be able to be an image bearer. You've put them in a small box where there's no air. Does that make sense?
Yes.
That's what happens when we don't image bear and rather bear idols, is we multiply by number according to our way of thinking, according to our suke or our bios, rather than allow them to flourish to be more image bearers, to flourish in God's rhythm, and to flourish in naming and tending and multiplying others. What happens when I step out of cohort is I use authority or power or control for my benefit. The ultimate purpose for choosing to follow an idol is to maintain independence, maintain control over some part of my life, and avoid vulnerability. That is the primary reason we go toward idols. Is I want to maintain my control over my life and avoid vulnerability. I want to avoid wounding. I want to avoid putting myself into and letting others rule and control and have authority to become all they can be. I want to make sure I don't get hurt in any way.
Isn't it also like I want to be able to name what is good?
It's exactly what we have here, right? I name what is good. And we talked about this, boy, I think back in Joshua. We talked about that tree of good and evil. That was, I want to make the choices about what's good and bad. Mm-hmm. I don't want God to tell me what's good and bad. I want to make the choice. That's what idol does, right? I want to maintain my independence, my control over what I say is good and what I say is bad. So, what we have here, this is the background. You need to know this so you understand what God is doing in Judges. So, what we have from Genesis on is then the story of God restoring our image bearing. And how he does that is he does that through the history of Israel, and then he explodes it in the New Testament. God's story is a story of raising up a people for restoration to wholeness, so they can be a model and then an invitation to come join the cohort. I'm creating a cohort so that they get to be a model and they get to do exactly what I've done and call into cohort. That's what God is doing from Genesis on. He is actually creating his cohort there as a model. What he does is he progressively reveals the ways he's going to restore us to image bearing. The same way we do with raising our children, right? We don't give them everything at once. We give them little by little where they can understand. We teach them first concrete so that they can live in an abstract world. What I mean by that is we don't teach them, we don't say to our one-year-old, now be careful with the stove, because to be careful is abstract. What do we say to a one-year-old? Don't touch the stove. That's concrete. But we teach them concrete so that eventually they can understand abstract. We don't say to them, love your brother, although we do a lot, and it confuses them. Love your brother. We say, now hug your brother, right? We give them concrete so that eventually they can learn abstract. This is exactly what God does. So when we look at Scripture and we see how he's organized it, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, as we go through that, God is teaching them concrete things about abstract principles. And you need to know that so that you don't get all confused when we go into Judges and people and God is saying, you need to kill these people. Because this is a big issue in Judges, right? It's the concrete so that we understand the abstract. I'll give you that a little bit more picture of that in a minute. So what we have in Exodus, God brings out a people. He brings out a people out. He brings them out of slavery to brokenness, out of living in a place of just having suke and bios. Because when I only have suke and bios, I actually have to bargain for life, to get life. Because I have no power source, so I'm going to have to bargain for it. And he brings them out of there. That's Exodus. So I guess what I should say is, so in this Bible study for the last, I think, 7, 8, 9 years, we've tried to go back and forth, but we're trying to get through all of the Old Testament. So we've done Genesis almost all the time, but not as a whole. We've done Genesis as the basis. We've done Exodus. We've done Leviticus. We skipped Numbers because it's basically Leviticus. Deuteronomy. Joshua. So we're in Judges. So what we're understanding is God is raising up children from the concrete to the abstract so that we understand why there's so much concrete in the Old Testament, but toward the end of the Old Testament, and actually even in the middle, it becomes more abstract and more abstract. He's raising up children. He brings them out of a brokenness place. In Leviticus and in Numbers, he trains them. So he trains them, first of all, in Leviticus. He says, I'm going to give you a purpose. Oh, going back to creation. And your purpose is to be priests. To be priests who go first. To be my representative, my image bearer. I want you to do this. You go first, Israel. So you be the model. And in being the model, what I want you to do and what I'm training you to do is to set up a way of living in cohort with me and with others. I'm going to train you to be able to set up a way of living in cohort, which is no surprise that he does this. He trains them in the desert. In the desert where rarely another person is seen, so that they really get involved in cohort. And he says, not only do I want you to set up a way of living in cohort, I want it to embody image bearing, embody what cohort really means, this mutually dependent lifting up the weight and glory of another, depending on one another. And as you set this way up of living, then I want you to offer to others to join the cohort. This is what he tells them in Leviticus. this is the book of the priests. I want you to be priests. And so he takes a small part of Israel and says, I want you to be priests to the rest of Israel, so then all Israel can be priests in the place I bring you. And then all Israel can be priests to all the world. They can all be cohort asking to be joining in. That's the training he gives them. And in the training, he says, now, this is what I want you to do. This is your purpose. Now, here are the places I want you to be it in. Here are the rhythms, and here are the directions. And, of course, the rhythm is going to be create and relate. And anytime we talk about resting, remember, it's always that stepping back and remembering. Remembering, put all the pieces back together. Oh, here's the whole. It's God's breath. I'm created to be just like him, to delight in making the good into the very good, to bring flourishing to all creation. I remember the wholeness, the sanctity, so that his rhythm in concrete terms is, on 6 days you work, and on the seventh day you rest. This is the concrete, he says. I want you to live this rhythm. And he allows them to do that in the desert. Get into the rhythm, as we do with the liturgy. And I completely forgot the liturgy, didn't I? So, yep, not in. So I did not do that rhythm. I have to get in that rhythm, too. Sorry, Lara Jean. I'm going to let you break into me after we do group work, which I didn't do either. I get so excited about the lesson. It's not special for today. We'll kind of go back into that. No, I have it taped. I haven't done the liturgy. So don't worry, the tape is there. He gives them the rhythm in the desert so they can learn it and become a part of them, so that when they get into the place where they're to be a model, they're used to it. And they live this rhythm, and it's supposed to be for a model. And it gives them direction. So in Deuteronomy, the thing he says over and over and over again is, remember, I'm the one who brought you out, and I'm going to be the one who brings you in. Follow my lead, in other words. Follow my lead. I brought you out. I'm going to bring you in. Follow my lead. And he says, here's my lead. Here are the directions. And in Deuteronomy, we have the second giving of the law, right? Here are the directions to be able to be image bearers, to be able to flourish. Here are the tools and the place that you need to flourish. And it's going to begin with, number one, remember, I brought you in, I'm bringing you out. Remember, follow me, follow me, follow me. That's what the rest is about, to remember, to follow him. And the very first thing he says is, have no other gods before you. Don't follow any other lead. It's the very first thing you need to know. Don't follow any other lead. And continue to be vulnerable in connection with me and others. And here's the concrete way to do that. And we have the Ten Commandments. That's the kind of compressed version of, here are the directions of being vulnerable, of connecting. And so we have, honor your father and mother. We have, do not steal, do not covet. And right in the middle we have, rest, rest. Keep the rhythm. It's going to give you the power and the energy to do this and follow the directions. This is what will help you flourish. This is the water and the air and the warmth you need to grow into more than what you are right now. You're going to grow into priests, is what he says to them. The rhythm and directions show the Israelites how to use the power that he has shared with them, how to rightly use the power, and also how not to abuse the power. So that's Deuteronomy. We have Exodus, we have Leviticus and Numbers, a training, giving them purpose. You're going to be my priests. This is who you are. I'm going to name worth here. I'm going to give you rhythm and direction. Okay, now you got it? Okay, let's go. Let's go. You know, you see those tour guys in the White House. We're walking, you know, right, right. That's what he's saying. We're walking, let's practice this. You know, they practice fire drills, right? Come on, guys, we're walking out, let's practice. That's what he does in the desert with them. We're walking, and they didn't get it, so they had to walk and walk, right, for 40 years. So that they would get the rhythm down, and that they would get following the leader down. Then in Joshua, finally, we have him bringing them in. And he has them bring them, he brings them in order to take possession of the place that they're going to be the model priests, the model image bearers. He brings them into the place. And I'm going to stop here and go back to that idea of progressive revelation of God, that he first teaches the concrete to go to the abstract, because we confuse this a lot. We have him, them bringing him into the Israelites into a land to take possession of the land. And that's what we're going to see all in Judges, right? I want you to take possession of the land. Land is concrete. Funny thing, Jesus never talks about land, ever. What he does talk about is life. I came to bring you into life. What kind of life? Full life. Abundant life. Flourishing life. I want you to take possession of flourishing life. So that when we see the Israelites coming in Joshua and Judges, into the land, and God's continual, take possession of it, take possession of it. Be all you were supposed to be in the land. Take all of the land that I've given you. We look at the abstract, God saying, would you take possession of all I have meant you to be? Would you flourish? Would you choose to be part of the cohort so that participating in my being overflows? That's taking possession of the land. Does this make sense? So we always have to translate what is the principle of the concrete in Judges to the abstract where we live today. Hebrews, actually, when they heard land that it was given, their thought was, it's not simply a piece of real estate. We think of land as simply a piece of real estate. But they considered land as the reality of being, because it gave them a sense of belonging. Remember, throughout the entire history of Israel, they never have a place where they actually belong. From Abraham on, right? They're always wandering, always wandering. They have some years here for a little bit, some years here, but nothing ever belongs to them. They never belong to a place. So for them, land is a place of belonging, a place where they can actually be rooted. And that means I get to flourish here. This is where I flourish. This is where I gain all my sustenance, and I can rest here. So you see why God so urgently cares about them possessing all the land, because he wants them to be full, to be able to fully accomplish rest and work. Creating and relating, being fully who they can be. And they can only do that in the place of belonging in the cohort for us. So We have Joshua taking possession. We've gone through Joshua. We know that when they take possession, they're going to need to start building their cities, right? But do they have a nice clean slate to build their cities on? What does Joshua and the Israelites build their city on? Rubble. They build it on rubble. They build it on what they tore down. Why? Because the direction said, have no other gods before me. So they must tear down everything that stands for bearing independence. Everything that stands for being outside of the cohort. They're going to be models. They can't come in and build next to. They must destroy it so that they can build on the rubble. That's the foundation. The foundation is, remember me, I'm the one who brought you in, brought you out. Have no other gods. You can't have another god standing there who's saying, walk with me, walk with me. No other gods. It must start there. So that's the way they're going to build the cities in Joshua. And that's what Joshua and the Israelites do. Until we now get to Judges. And what happens in Judges? In Judges, they lose sight of the lead. It says in the first two chapters of Judges, there arose another generation who did not know the Lord. The word there is experience. They did not have any experience with the Lord's breath, with Zoe. There were lost rhythms somewhere. And they did not know the work which he had done. They had no experience of his naming worth, of his tending, and of his multiplying to flourishment. They had no experience of it, which is kind of funny because we see even within Judges, even Gideon says, well, you did this back there. What happens in Judges is the forefathers told them the information. They said, this is what God did. But they didn't share their stories. They didn't share their experiences with God. And so they only passed down information. Stories is their is the lyrics to their rhythm. Here's what happened to me. It was real. It's the place that others can enter in. I tell story so others can enter into my experience. If I give information, there's no entry point. That's why scripture is almost 80% story. It gives entry point into experiencing God. The generation that is raised in Judges has no experience with God's breath, his rhythm. They've told the rhythm. They're given it as an obligation, but there's no experience of it giving life, and there's no experience of him naming and tending and multiplying. So, battles become a necessity for a couple reasons. Why do they have to have battles? Why is it filled with battles they don't initiate? Because God is trying to kindle a longing for home, a longing for restoration. Right now, a longing to come back to cohort. They began to follow what they saw. And since they didn't see God's breath, God's leading, they saw what was on the outside of them. Other places, other things, other ways of living. And they became comfortable with that. They saw, here's an interesting thing. they came out of Egypt, out of a place where they really didn't know the God that would become theirs. They had all sorts of gods, and each god had different places. One god ruled the waters, and one god ruled the land, and one god ruled each animal. When they came into the desert, God says, I am your God. I am the God of all things. I am your God. And their forefathers had an experience of God leading them through the desert and God providing for them. Now they get to a place. In Egypt, they knew a place that you lived by the river. There was lots of food always available. You could irrigate everything because of the land. They get to the desert, and God provides for them in a place where there's no irrigation. They get into Israel. Now this is completely different because Israel is mountainous and rocky, and they, in Israel, have to depend on rain. Not rivers, but rain. They've experienced a God who's able to provide for them in the desert by bringing water out of rocks. But now they come into a land where they need rain. And they come into a land where there's already gods, and it's the gods there, Baals in particular, are gods who actually, they have a whole way of living around Baal. It's all about bringing rain. So they've entered a place where there are gods that bring rain. And they're going, well, these gods bring rain. What do you, God, know about bringing rain? You were a god of the desert. And we're in a place that needs rain to live. Not rain out of the rocks, but rain. And there's already a god set up here. You see the lure all of a sudden? We don't know a god who brings rain. God never brought rain in the desert to them. We don't know a god there, but they've got a god who brings rain. And so he needs to kindle for them a longing for cohort, a longing for home and restoration. And it begs the question for us, am I clinging too tightly to my expectations of how life should go? Have I so bought into the transactional idea of, if I do what is right, then I'll have the life I think I should have? That we are satisfied with having a God who brings rain. That we're satisfied with this transactional life. Because it's working pretty well right now. You know, I go to church and I give my children everything they need, and everything just works out great. And God says, you're not whole. You need to have a longing for wholeness. And you don't long for wholeness. What's that great quote that C.S. Lewis, I think it's C.S. Lewis, right? You're sitting at the seaside and you're content with the mud pies. Just turn around. Long for the ocean. Long for flourishing. You're giving up. You're satisfied with a rain god. And I'm a god who can make you flourish. And so he brings battles to kindle that longing and to inflame a passion for image bearing. You know, we often in Christian circles talk about our desires are bad. But our true desire, our true passion is actually for image bearing. It's just that we've hidden it over all sorts of junk. That's what he's trying to do. Inflame it. And he's going to have to put flames to it. To all the leaves that we've covered over it with. So that all of a sudden again we have this passion to flourish in being image bearers. To flourish in being whole. In participating in his being. To come to that point where whatever it needs, God, I'll go through it. So that I'm whole and others are whole. Rather than our normal, what is our normal response to battles, to hardships, to things happening that we don't like, what's our normal response?
Avoidance.
Or, God, don't let this happen. Please don't let this happen. I mean, even little things. And this is why I said the rain was an answer to prayer today. My prayer was that it would rain today because my neighbor is having a patio put in, and yesterday there were construction trucks all lining the street. And so I'm praying for rain so you guys have a place to park.
And they're praying it won't rain so they can get paid for their job.
Exactly. Exactly. So again,
I don't know.
See, it's, yeah, I want these people to flourish and not these. And really, could you not have flourished by parking a little farther down? He wants to inflame in us a passion for image bearing, no matter what it takes. I want wholeness no matter what it takes. I will go through whatever surgery it requires to get me healthy, right? I will go through whatever rehab it requires to get me healthy. Robin has an injury, and she could have surgery or not have surgery, but she wants to be whole. So she's going to elect for surgery. I'm going to go through surgery. And she's already been told, and I think by Don, how horrible the surgery is. And she goes, it doesn't matter. I want to be whole. This is what God is inflaming in us in the battles. I want to be whole, no matter what it takes. How's he going to do this? He's going to test our homesickness. He's going to test whether we really want to be in cohort or not. How homesick really am I for kingdom? For heaven and earth to be again united? Is my comfort here in the transactional world too important? Is my wanting to have a life that works out just like I thought it should too important to me that I'm not homesick to be whole? So he will do it by testing us, it says in Judges, and it's testing us for our homesickness, and also by teaching us war. He wants us to experience that the type of life we're living right now, that transactional life, where suke or bios is in control, he wants us to experience that that's not what we've been made for. He wants us to experience the failure of suke being in charge, of bios being in charge, of our comfort and what we feel is right. He wants us to experience that failure. It's what the best parents do, right? They allow their child to fail because, in fact, every big-name inventor, I think even Steve Jobs said this. What was his best teacher? Failure. It was the things he failed at that taught him what is true and what is real. And God is a good parent. And so he wants us, actually, to experience failure. He wants us to experience the failure of us, of our will and our way of thinking, leading us, of our physical desires, of the feeling that this is how I am, to lead us. Remember, we talked about identity. And our identity must be image of God. That is our identity. Nothing else. My identity must be image of God, or I will never be full. I will never flourish because I will be going toward a wrong place. In fact, when we talk about following on maps, right? Our theme is maps and backpacking and things. When we follow, we use what to know where we're going?
Compass.
A compass, right? A compass. The interesting thing is, There are two Norths. Do you know this? Trillian? What are the two Norths?
Well, there's True North and the Magnetic North, which is affected by where you are in the scheme of things.
Yep. So if you follow Magnetic North, you most likely won't get to your destination. You must know where True North is. Your Magnetic North is going to be what your Suke says is good. What your bio says is good. Mm-hmm. That's your Magnetic North. And you will follow that. And the farther you follow that, the farther usually you get from True North, from your destination of being an image bearer, of being fully participating in the being of God. I'm trying to decide whether I should go on or stop from there. Do you feel like your head is just exploding right now?
Yeah.
Okay. I am going to stop there. I'm not going to go on. What is, just so you know, the end part of that is the things that we will see in Judges. It's actually some of the key words of Judges. See and try and judge and rest. The interesting thing is those four pieces, truth, mercy, justice, and peace, those are actually the directions and the formulas for any group that does reconciliation. It's the national way to bring reconciliation. They do this with political parties. They do this with nations. This is what they do. Interesting that this is what Judges is going to bring us to. What I would like to do is I would like to take a moment just for your own thoughts. Be silent. And we're going to kind of go back to our doxology. We're going to go back to rhythm. Normally, if I was following rhythm, when we sat down, and this is what you will do next week, I will put you into groups, and your groups will be according to the color of your folders that you got, your mapping. And next week, you will share in that group just a quick, from ages 1 to 10, did I have any Zoe awareness? Did I see God anywhere? Did I feel God anywhere? Did I feel his presence anywhere? And you're just going to share that with the group. And you're going to start from whoever has the first name of the alphabet. So, you know, there's no Ann in here, but if we had Ann, Ann's going to go first in your group. And then Barbara's going to go second, and Cindy's going to go third. So no leader, your cohort. Okay, so you're going to work together and hold each other up. 1 through 10, you may all get to share. Some of you may not have anything to share. Maybe from ages 1 to 10, you didn't have anything. You didn't see God anywhere. You didn't have any sense. Fine, no problem. When we continue to go through this, you might go back and go, oh, I think I did actually. So ages 1 to 10, there might not be a lot, so you might all get to share. Maybe not. Maybe only some of you. The next time you get to share, pick it up for other people to share. Does that make sense? So everyone will come in here. Largene will start with, he leadeth me. Then you'll go to groups, and I'll just tell you to go to groups. It's important here, the groups are only 10 minutes. This is not, you know, we don't have the luxury because of the amount of people we have to have a long time. But it's just sharing little pieces where you saw God in ages 1 to 10. So, in fact, some of you will probably just stand in your group. You might not even sit down. I'll send some to the living room, some to the dining room, some will stay here, and some will go toward the back there. I was hoping you'd go outside. We'll do that. That's the group work that you see on your liturgy cards. Then I will let Laura Jean, after the 10-minute time, start in with a doxology. And as soon as you hear that music, you drop everything, you stop everything, and you sing doxology as you're coming back together. Okay? Once we're all back together here, I'm going to let you quiet yourself. And then we'll together say the confession. After we say the confession, then I'll teach. So if I start teaching, somebody gently say, rhythm. We need to be in rhythm. I have a problem with rhythm. I just want to keep going and going. So I need help there, cohort. Help me there. And after the lesson, after I pray, then Laura Jean will send you forth, and we'll answer that. So with the last 5 minutes, I want us to actually go through doxology, confession, and the conference of going out. So, Laura Jean, would you mind starting doxology?
Praise God from whom all blessings flow. Praise Him, all creatures here below. Praise Him above, the heavenly hosts. Praise Father, Son, and Holy Ghost.
Most merciful God,
we confess that we have sinned against you in thought, word, and deed, by what we have done and by what we have left undone. We have not loved you with our whole heart. We have not loved our neighbors as ourselves. We are truly sorry, and we humbly repent. For the sake of your Son, Jesus Christ, have mercy on us and forgive us, that we may delight in your will and walk in your ways to the glory of your name. Amen.
Let me pray, and then you can confer. Father, thank you for this time, for these women, for this cohort, for the ability to participate in being. May we experience the flourishing you're inviting us to in participating in creating with you. Amen.
Go forth into the world in peace, rejoicing in the power of the Spirit.
Thanks be to God.